Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 22nd day of May, Anno Domini 2021, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. We are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news.
Well, first I want to thank Dennis for covering for me last week.
Dennis did a great job. Nothing taken away from you, but we do love having Dennis here. He's lots of fun. All right, Windows 10. This is actually a great story. Windows 10 comes with its own baked-in antivirus solution called Windows Defender, and it is enabled by default when setting up a new PC. At the very least, that affords you some basic protection against many malware threats out in the wild. But did you know there is an added optional layer that keep your pictures, videos, work documents, and other files safe in the event of a ransomware infection?
No. We did not.
You did not, but now you will. The caveat is you have to manually enable ransomware protection in Windows 10, or more specifically, a feature called controlled folder access. To enable it, you can either take the long way around by navigating to settings, update and security, click on Windows Open Security, open Windows Security, click on Virus and Threat Protection, scroll down and click on Manage Ransomware Protection, or you can just type Ransomware Protection in the Windows search bar. Probably a little easier.
Yeah, a little bit.
The controlled folder access toggle is set to off by default. Turning it on designates specific folders that only trusted applications have permission to access, and you can add folders beyond the ones that are selected by default. There's also a section to grant specific apps permission to access your protected folders if need be. Ransomware ranks as one of the biggest and fastest growing malware threats, with a massive 62% spike in attacks in 2020 compared to the year before, according to data outlined in SonicWall's 2021 Cyber Threat Report. According to the report, the effects of a global pandemic combined with record highs in the price of cryptocurrency drove ransomware to new heights, and it's not showing any signs of slowing down. There were more than 304 million ransomware attacks last year. Not all of them successfully extorted money from victims, but according to Coveware, a ransomware mediation service, the average ransomware payment grew to over $220,000 in the fourth quarter of last year. Of course, those are mainly businesses forking over that kind of money to attackers who are holding their data hostage. Small businesses in particular are disproportionately targeted, but facilitators of ransomware do also go after individuals. As to the ransomware protection in Windows 10, it does actually work. The PC Security Channel on YouTube posted a video several weeks ago showing the mechanism in action. After installing a pretty deadly ransomware strain on a test system, the controlled folder access feature prevented the designated folders from being altered, while non-protected folders ended up encrypted. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows 10 has a ransomware block. That's great. Your choices are that's great, that's interesting, Windows what now, and of course, other. So far we have 27 votes. That's interesting, and Windows what now are tied. And of course, if you said other, we'd love you to head over to our forums at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And scroll down on the right under fascinating stuff. You'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least the number one item under poll discussion is 22 May 21. Windows 10 has a ransomware block. And if you said other, we'd love to have you leave your comment there. And even if you didn't say other, you can leave your comment there. And of course, and this might come as a shock to you, you can also give us a call. Unbelievable, isn't it? 585-9- 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. And we will be honored and delighted to take your call today. And of course, Steve is setting up the YouTube video. Thank you last week for putting the audio stream online and adding things into the posts. Thank you very much for that.
And I'm figuring out that remote program.
Very
that
exciting.
Will allow you to bring in video from different people in different places. So when I'm stuck at work, I can maybe still bring the video feed in.
Perfect.
Everyone on their own device.
Right. Hmm. Very nice.
Cool.
So Steve is our audio video expert.
Whether he wants to be or
right, at least as close as we can get. So if you have a call for anything, pretty much, we'll be happy to at least pretend we know something about it. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Go ahead.
I'm going to say one of the problems that we're starting to see now with ransomware on the rise is that insurance companies are now selling ransomware insurance to large companies.
Right.
So the company doesn't really have to pay that much, but the insurance companies are. And there was a story that came out yesterday that one of the largest insurance companies has reportedly paid $40 million to ransomware hackers in the last while.
Yep.
And their demands are rising because they know there's an insurance company behind them now with big bucks that can pay that giant.
Yeah, deep pockets.
Yeah.
If I were the insurance company, I would be demanding that all of my companies used the Windows Defender ransomware block. And it's a clever idea. If an application, a program, is not trusted, it cannot write to those folders.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with that is if the ransomware comes to you through a Microsoft Word document or an Excel spreadsheet, then you're still going to get in. And there's nothing, you know, there's no way around that. You still have the issue of people who are not that paying that much attention, let's put it that way.
Yeah, one of the things that the insurance companies are doing is negotiating with the ransomware. So apparently in this last one that they were talking about, the ransomware hackers initially wanted $60 million, and the insurance company negotiated down to $40
million. That's
And that pipeline that got shut down. They paid $4.5 million to ransomwares. But now the story is coming out that the hack had nothing to do with the oil delivery.
Right.
It was the billing computers. We can't bill anyone, so we're going to shut down the flow of oil, and now gas prices have jumped and you know, almost doubled in some cases.
Right.
Nothing to do with the flow of oil.
Nothing to do with it. They didn't stop that at all.
No, it was just still going, but yet that was an excuse to raise the price of gas.
Right. If they can't make money off it, they're not going to send it out anywhere. Yeah. So I get that.
Prices always jump fast, but they take a long time to drop back down again. Yeah.
And of course, you know, nobody waits. I just filled my underground tank at my
lair.
My gas station.
Your secret lair.
No, my gas station. I just filled it at, you know, $2 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
So I could continue to sell that gas
at
$2 a gallon. But the price is now $3 a gallon, so I'm going to make an extra buck a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I get it.
And there were pictures of people that were filling the same people that caused the toilet roll shortage were causing gasoline shortages by filling plastic buckets those plastic totes that you buy with gasoline.
Right.
Just waiting for the gas to eat through.
Did you see that one picture of the Suburban?
With plastic bags.
No, this guy had gone and gotten a whole surplus of gas.
Yeah.
And he was going
smoking
back
on the way home.
Smoking on the way home, and the vehicle caught on fire.
Yep.
And I guess the vehicle was only like a couple months old.
Yep.
Plus the hundreds of dollars of gas he had in the back.
Yeah.
Well, there's that
massive explosion.
That one meme going around about, you know, once you filled your bathtub with gasoline, you can put scented candles around it so it blocks the odor.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, then these people are stuck with that gasoline when the prices do go down.
Yep.
they're stuck with $3-4 a gallon gas. And of course, the price didn't go up quite that much here.
No, it wasn't too bad. Well, they got it settled very fast.
Yeah,
it was resolved. You know,
well, and someone had asked me this week, you know, why do people pay the ransom? Won't that just encourage more ransom attacks? And the answer is yes, yes, it will. Don't pay it, but I have to get all my files back.
Well, and the real problem is that people don't have good backups.
Yeah.
What do we keep preaching? What's that one word we keep saying over and over and over again?
And how long have we been saying it?
Backups, exactly. If
decades.
You have good backups, and particularly if you have an off-site backup, a disconnected backup, you should be in fairly good shape.
One of the things that we've started seeing, Bruce Schneier and some of the other security researchers have done these deep dives in how the ransom attacks. The people, the bad guys are staying inside systems for a lot longer. They don't encrypt your data immediately.
Right.
They wait. They watch your backup schedule to make sure your backups are encrypted. You know, if you have a rotating offsite backup, they'll wait until that's encrypted too before that actually triggers the actual encryption.
Right.
So you know, it's the bad guys are getting smarter, and you have to be a really smart good guy now to be able to.
Well, if you're testing your backups regularly,
yeah,
you know whether or not you got a good backup.
Yeah, if you can't read your backup file, something's wrong.
Something's not right there.
Yeah.
At any rate, you have to remember that these things can also hit individuals, because many of these attacks are, yes, targeted at high-profile places. But others are just automated. They will hit whoever they can hit. Computers don't care.
And it hits average people at high-profile locations. You know, you get an email that says, here's your new HR package. You're going to open it.
Right. and that's an issue that we all have to deal with. You may never pay the ransom. You may not care. But that doesn't mean you won't get hit, because it is an automated thing that just hits whoever it can hit.
No, in my case, they turn around and say, we'll pay you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the other thing that's happening is in addition to the money for ransom, the bad guys are copying all your data. We saw that in the Sony hack. And so when Sony didn't pay the ransom, they started releasing embarrassing documents and contract negotiations and what the executives thought of the celebrities. And
right.
So if you're not going to pay the ransom, we'll embarrass you in public.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So remember, never say anything in email or anywhere else that you wouldn't
want. Might come back to bite you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's just no privacy anymore on the internet. Zuckerberg famously said it about Facebook. Privacy is dead.
Well,
he
that's where
that, and it is true. Be careful what you say, where you say it, how you say it, because it will come back and bite you.
That's where I think you'll see again another opportunity for a company to start coming out with software that will guard against this rise of, you know, people being hacked and asking for ransomware.
Right.
So,
And there are, as the story mentioned, there are anti-ransomware programs and people that things that will watch against ransomware. But people don't update. They don't get the latest thing definitions installed. They click on links anyway.
Well, that's the other problem I have with Windows.
Oh, that's the one.
Granted, they have that feature built in.
Yep.
But the other key word is, how often does it get updated?
Yep. Right.
What?
Well, of course, the other problem is it's not by default. It's turned off by default.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that. There are some programs. For example, there are a couple of games that store their information in the documents folder. So when you first run them, they will refuse to run.
Mm-hmm.
Until you go into the ransomware section and say this program is okay.
Yeah, so Apple's latest OSs have started doing that. You know, X program wants access to your documents folder. The problem is people get click happy and say, yeah, go away.
You're right, exactly.
And if Microsoft Office needs access to your documents folder, that's okay. You know, but HackMe123 needs access to your documents folder. No!
No, it's probably
read
not a
the
good
message.
Idea. Right. Or this email that you're reading wants access to your documents folder. I think not.
I had a customer had a sneaky one the other day. It was notification spam. And she got a message on the screen that said, click allow to prove you're not a robot. And it was the CAPTCHA that we're all used to filling in.
Nice.
But the message was actually click allow to notifications from this website. But the picture on screen said, click allow to prove you're not a robot. So they clicked allow to let notifications in and started getting tons of fake notification messages.
Nice.
And the anti-malware program can't find that because it's a notification you allowed from
a
website.
You said
that
it was okay. Yeah.
We talk a lot about how Chromebooks don't get viruses, but you can still get caught by things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you purposely add a toolbar that is bad, yep. When you purposely say, okay, you can do this, Chrome, just like every other operating system, says, you're in charge. Yep. Here it comes.
They can't make it provisions for stupidity.
They should add, are you sure this has been reported as malicious or potentially unwanted?
Yeah, people still click.
Yeah,
they don't read.
They've been a click-happy society for the past two decades.
Yep.
You know, yeah. And then they wonder why they've, you know, and I know you've seen it too, Steve, is all these menu bars.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can have 8, 9 menu bars. And you look at their computer and you say, do you need all these? Well, I don't know how they got there. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
How? You tell them to. No, I didn't. Yes, you did.
Because they can't come in any other way.
Yeah. I said, you said right. It's okay for them to do that.
Right.
You didn't take the time to, you know, actually read it.
And that might have been a ride-along with a program you did install, which you probably shouldn't have if it has those types of ride-alongs.
Right.
Well, I just had another friend of mine was wondering, you know, show me their laptop. And they're sitting there saying, all this extra junk's on here.
Yeah.
And I said, what did you just install? And they told me about the program. I said, did you read all the stuff that was installing on top of it? Because it put in McAfee and it put in all these other tools and everything else. And they go, well, I just wanted this one program. And I said, yeah, but they give you the option to say decline. Yeah, but I wanted to get the program in. Yeah, you can still get the program installed, but you got to take time to read it. And it'll allow you to say decline if you don't want to install that extra baggage.
And a lot of times those extra things will conflict with each other. You know, McAfee pays a referral fee and Norton pays a referral fee. All these companies will pay referral fees. So if you're writing software, if you include their program, they pay you a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, let me include them all.
Sure.
And then you get, you know, multiple
unzip and all this other stuff, and it's like, so I went through there. I installed a Revo One installer on it. Matter of fact, he was going to get the paid version, and we wound up cleaning out all this stuff on his machine, and it's like, whoa! All of a sudden, it started running faster.
Yeah, exactly.
No stuff.
Well, that's the thing. If you look, the problem, of course, is that you have to know what you're looking at. Because you can look through the list of programs that are installed. You can put in something like Revo install, or look through it and say, oh, I don't want this, I don't want this, I don't want this. But too often what people say is, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, if you don't know what it is, don't uninstall it.
Right. It's this Win32 thing. I don't need 32 of those. I'm going to delete it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So you really need to be careful, or you ask a professional like Dave or Steve to do it for you. And yes, you'll pay a little money, but you're paying money for the knowledge that they've spent 40 years, in Dave's case, 240 years, acquiring. So it's worth a few bucks to get somebody who really knows what they're doing to fix your machine. I say that all the time. You can always DIY anything. But there's two parts to DIY. There's the doing, and there's the knowing what you're doing.
That can, you know.
And part of the problem is that that computer prices have been driven so far down. You know, go to a big box store and buy a computer for $200. You're not going to want to put $100 into fixing it.
Right.
So throw it away and buy a new one.
Right.
And then don't copy your data.
Give it to me and buy a new one.
Yeah.
Give it to me.
And you better not copy your data, because then you'll just copy the problem over too.
That's right.
So you better not, you know, don't do anything important.
Right. It gets to the point where we really have, you're right, they're disposable machines.
Yeah.
But because they're disposable, we think they're not worth anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And really the point is, the hardware itself isn't worth much. You can replace the hardware, like you said, for a couple of $100. It's the data that are important. It's the data that you care about. That's why so many people are now using online systems like Google Workspaces or OneDrive or Apple's iWork in order to keep
the data safer, because it's at someone else's computer too. Which is okay, but you still want to have your own backup just in case something goes wrong with their end.
Yeah.
Or heaven forbid that service shut down. How many cloud services have gone away and you lose your data? Or they change their terms. Google Photos now is going to start charging you for all those free photos you thought you had.
Unless you're on a Pixel phone.
Yeah.
So far. Yeah.
But that's one thing. When you talk about the ransomware and everything else, the only one thing that I have that would be any of my bank information.
Right.
Any of the letters. But I'm not too worried about that, because one, I back up to the cloud. I've got, two other Pi 4s that I back it up to. Plus, I have another one, because this is important to me. I've got another SSD drive that only gets turned on when I go to back it up. And I take the file and I literally drag it over there and then shut it off.
Yep.
Because to me, that is the other thing. Emails and any of the other stuff that I've got, they want it.
That's right.
Have at it, folks.
Take it. Who cares?
Yeah. And
I went to lunch with a friend of mine on Thursday. Wow, that's going to hurt me.
Yeah. Or, and like I say, I'm not too worried as far as my passwords, because I've got NPass. And that is, again, it's storing it up on the cloud. So that's all protected.
Already encrypted pretty heavily, too. So.
Yeah, and if they want to try to guess my passwords.
Right.
Good luck, because that is one thing I sit there and I look at some of them, because you can view them, folks. Once you set up, have it generate a password, you can sit there and say view. And you look at some of these and it's like, no way in heavens and, move earth way I'd ever remember this password in any lifetime.
Right.
Because, you can mix it up and everything else. And that's why we've encouraged folks for a long time now to use these products, because they keep you safe.
Right.
And they can help, as far as getting into your system and everything else, that you sit there and, I don't have to worry about it.
We had a customer come in this week, and their hard drive they store all their pictures on failed. So, well, that's okay, because we set you up with a backup in December. Right. I look at the backup drive. Guess when the last backup was?
December.
Yep. Never backed it up again. So, all right, we can get all your pictures back from December. But in the last 6 months, what have you done?
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Back with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Mina Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. Sound Bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
He doesn't have them tied together.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 35 minutes after the hour. Steve is rocking out.
Well, see, it's supposed to have
sound bites.
He's got music here And then there's also a liner, but he doesn't have them tied together.
They're not mixed.
Right. Yeah. Inside baseball. All right. again, I'm choking you to death on allergies. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Apple recently launched the latest version of its operating system, iOS 14.5, which features the much-anticipated app tracking transparency function, bolstering the tech giant's privacy credentials. But iOS 14.5 also introduced support for the new Apple AirTag, which risks doing the opposite. For the uninitiated, an AirTag is a small device similar to a tile. Am I allowed to say it's similar to a tile? Apple probably doesn't like hearing that.
Maybe.
That can be attached to personal items such as
tile
keys.
Doesn't like hearing that.
What?
Tile's already suing them.
Oh, yeah, they are. That can be attached to personal items such as keys, wallets, or luggage. Of course, you have to buy a separate device to attach it.
Oh,
tile
of
comes with a hole in it.
They sell them in four packs. Oh, yeah, the holders.
Yeah, the holders are extra.
Hermes makes holders for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars because it's Hermes leather.
Exactly. The tag periodically sends messages that can be used to track its location, letting you find any lost or missing items with the help of an app. While clearly useful, AirTags can potentially be misused. Concerns have been raised that they might facilitate stalking, for example. There's also a more fundamental issue with this technology. Its euphemistic description as a crowdsourced way to recover lost items belies the reality of how these items are tracked. What you won't find highlighted in the polished marketing statements is the fact that AirTags can only work by tapping into an Apple-operated surveillance network in which millions of us are unwitting participants. Each AirTag transmits a unique identifier using Bluetooth. Any compatible Apple device within range, up to 100 meters in ideal locations, conditions, will then relay that identifier to Apple servers, along with its own location data. The tag's owner can then log into the Find My app and access those locations and details, and bingo, you now have a pretty good idea where your lost bag is. The AirTags themselves have no positional location capability. They do not contain GPS technology. Rather, they merely ping the nearest Bluetooth-enabled device and let that device's location data do the rest. Besides Bluetooth, AirTags also use a relatively new technology called ultra-wideband. This new feature is supported only by recent Apple devices, such as the iPhone 11 and 12, and allows for much more precise location tracking. While the actual nature of the data transmitted is not too concerning, it's just a tag ID and a location. What makes it worrying is the sheer scale and number of devices involved. By using an AirTag, you are effectively availing yourself of a global monitoring network containing millions and millions of devices. Everyone's iPhone, assuming Bluetooth is enabled, and whose isn't, is listening for AirTags. When it hears one, it uploads details of that tag's identifier and the phone's location to Apple servers. Besides any privacy concerns, this also likely uses small amounts of your data allowance. That's probably fine most of the time, but if you're traveling internationally, you might be hit with unexpected charges if you've forgotten to disable data roaming. Apple says it has implemented a range of safeguards to detect and prevent attempts to use AirTags for stalking, including an alert triggered when an AirTag seems to be accompanying someone who's not its owner. The alert can appear in the victim's phone if they use an iPhone, but can also raise an audible alert on the tag itself. But these measures are relatively easy to circumvent, as researchers have shown time and time again. So how do you feel about Apple's giant tagging network? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
What's kind of interesting is it's highlighting that your phone is already tracking you.
Yes.
and people are kind of freaking out about it. But there have been some interesting stories. One person mailed an AirTag to a friend and watched it go through the mailing system because so many people had iPhones, the postal carriers, the carrier annexes, and the sorting machines, and he followed it all along the way. I almost like that better than you know, the typical UPS and FedEx tracking.
Yeah.
I've been tracking a box from California, and it's got scanned in Riverside.
Yeah.
And then, where are you? And then 4 days later, it got scanned in Syracuse.
Yeah.
You missed.
Yeah, at least a couple. I got one last week. At 9 o'clock, I got a message. I got, you know, day of delivery messages. 9 o'clock, I got a message. It said it would be delivered between 10 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
At 10, I got a message. It said it would be delivered between 11 and 4. At 10:30, at 10:15, I got a message. It said it was on my porch. I said, okay. There we are. All right, let's head to the phones. Our first caller is from Rochester, New York, and is it Carol or Cheryl?
Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl. What's up?
I have a Pixel 4a, which I love, thanks to your recommendation.
Glad you like it.
Yeah, it's great. Finally have some memory in my phone. But recently, I've been having problems with the smart lock. It works in my car with the Bluetooth, so when I'm in my car, it stays unlocked. But at home, it keeps locking. And I've got my home address is in there.
Yep.
The only thing I can figure is, you know, at the top it says which email address it's connected to, and I have probably 3 or 4 different email addresses. So I'm wondering if maybe that's why it's not connected to the right email address.
No, the problem is it's in the GPS system. If you have GPS turned off, your phone can't tell where it is and therefore unlock.
Okay.
If you have GPS on, it may not be precise enough. So, for example, in my house, I had the same exact issue. My smartphone would not be unlocked.
Because of the geo mapping.
In my home. So I actually one day I went and looked at the geo map and said, where am I? And it said I was next door.
Mm-hmm.
So I just told it home is next door, and now it unlocks all the time.
You can't update the geo map?
No, this is as close as it will get to my house.
Yeah.
In terms of GPS, now GPS, the GPS system can go down to like you know, tenth of a meter for the military, but for civilians, it's much, much less precise.
Yeah. We have a problem with. With the geo mapping with us in our company, you go to like an apartment complex, it'll say, okay, the person is right here. And they have us coming in on another street. Well, if you come in on that street, you're going to drive through somebody's backyard because those are all houses.
Yeah.
Yep.
But that person lives right behind over that fence.
Yeah, you know where they are. You can see them from where you are.
Yeah,
you can't get there from here.
But that's the problem, Cheryl. It's most likely to be a GPS issue.
Yep.
And many times the systems will also add Wi-Fi locations to help the GPS be more precise. But then Google got in trouble for mapping Wi-Fi locations.
Right.
For the longest time, in our office, we would go to Google Maps and it would think we're somewhere in California. Because apparently that's where our router came from. And it took months before it knew we were in Victor. And then would show us where we were.
Right. You're right. I used to be able to keep my phone unlocked simply by saying, when I'm on this network, unlock me. But that feature no longer exists. So, Cheryl, honestly, the best you can do is to have your phone tell you where it thinks you are. Look at Google Maps. And see where it thinks you are. And if it thinks you're next door, tell it that's home. And it will then unlock it around your house. The other thing you can do is have some other device that it can unlock to. So, for example, I unlock to my smartwatch. When I am wearing my smartwatch, my phone is unlocked.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a smartwatch. I tried doing it with keeping it unlocked when it was on me, but... You know, you're not moving constantly. So
right.
You're still locking all the time. But so is it, it's not in the location settings, right? I have to go into Google Maps somehow.
Right. Well, that tells you where the phone thinks it is.
Yep.
Then in the location setting, you tell it, all right, my home is not 4 Main Street, it's 6 Main Street. Because it thinks you're at 6 Main Street.
There should be a little button. There should be a little button that looks like an arrow that says that's your current location,
right?
And then it will point on the map to where it thinks your current location
right.
is.
And if you click on that little button there, it'll say 6 Main Street. Then you go into your location app and say home is 6 Main Street. And then it will stay unlocked. So when you come home, it will take you next door. But I think you can figure out where you are from there.
Yeah, okay. I'll play around with that a little bit.
Yeah, I wish it was, like Steve said, they got sued for using the Wi-Fi network, so they don't anymore.
So they were collecting Wi-Fi names and locations.
Right.
And one of the things that your Wi-Fi router always broadcasts is its name. And they got sued under some privacy law about you shouldn't be collecting names. Well, you have a radio in your house that is broadcasting its name.
Yeah.
Beyond the walls of your house. How is that illegal?
Yeah, right.
So is that why it used to work and now it's not, really?
Yep. I had exactly the same issue. Suddenly it was locking. And then one time I was actually visiting my next door neighbors. I used to know them. And I was visiting them and noticed my phone was unlocked. which was my clue. Because I went to do something, you know, I went to call somebody or something. I opened my phone and it was unlocked. And I thought, what happened here? So I later on, I did some research and that's what I found out. So it's not an error as such. You know, it's not bad programming or anything like that. It's just, it's an artifact of the way the systems work now. So if you have some device in your home, like your if you can connect it to your computer, or, you know, like I can connect it to my Chromebook, for example, as well, and say whenever my Chromebook is unlocked, unlock the phone.
If I use a pattern to unlock it, but I've been afraid to switch it, like, to the fingerprint. I mean, is that very accurate all the time? Like, I'm thinking, what happens if it all of a sudden doesn't recognize my fingerprint and I'm locked out of the phone?
Couple of things. You've always got the backup of a PIN number. Secondly, I use a fingerprint all the time, and I've got actually 4 fingerprints in there. Both my thumbs, both my first fingers.
And some people put their spouse's fingerprint in it, too. Just
right, right. So you can add, really, I don't remember if there's a limit to the number of fingerprints you can add. Probably, but I don't know what that limit is. But at any rate, you can add fingerprints all you like. You could probably add your dog's nose to it if you want.
One of the things, too, is that it is probably safer than a pattern because someone can watch you make your pattern from a long way away. And then if they get your phone, they can do the same pattern.
Right.
Yeah. But if the fingerprint didn't work, I could still use the pattern as a backup.
Right, and I will say that once in a while, if I'm sloppy, I try to unlock it with the side of my finger accidentally. It doesn't work, and I have to do it a second time. But that's me, not the phone.
And that's where, you know, having, like you said, multiple, your both thumbs.
Right.
Depending on what might be on your hand, if you had grease or oil that it can't read it correctly, use the other hand, and as long as that's on file.
Yeah.
Or if your fingers are too dry, a lot of times.
Or too wet,
yeah. That's kind of close.
Right, but you always have that backup of your PIN.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot for the help. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Have fun.
And then when Apple came out with Face ID to read your face, they said that was even better than a fingerprint.
Right.
And then we started wearing masks.
Well, also, at one point, early on, you could hold up a picture of somebody and we're unlocked.
Yeah, then the 3D sensor, it actually takes a 3D face map, not just a... So some people have been able to 3D print latex masks, like in a Hollywood mask, and that...
Right.
And twins sometimes have trouble.
Twins have trouble. People of color
sometimes
have
been
having problems. They're fixing those, but they have problems with face unlock.
When we started wearing masks, when the COVID crisis hit, Apple reduced the time it would wait to get a face match before it jumped you to the fingerprint,
right?
Or the passcode, because they knew, you know, by the time you take your mask off that you shouldn't do, and
right. But there's we want to keep our phones safe, but we still want the convenience.
Mm-hmm. There's some interesting, not quite legislation yet, but there are people that are putting forth that your phone should be protected under Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Because it's an extension of your brain. It's remembering things about you that you don't remember.
Right.
It's got health data on it. It's got all sorts of personal information on it. It should be protected as an extension of your brain, and police shouldn't be able to get a warrant for it for self-incrimination.
Right. We were talking about some of that stuff last week in the in the lounge. Don't forget, every Sunday night at 9 o'clock, we meet in the Soundbites Lounge. You can go to soundbites.org/lounge, LOUNGE, and you'll see at 9 o'clock you will see a link to the lounge. You're more than welcome to join us. It's essentially a video chat, and we will be happy to answer your questions, or we just chit chat about whatever we feel like chit chatting about. And we talked about some of that stuff over the last couple of weeks. It's interesting to me how people's ideas of privacy. You know, they complain. People complain about, oh, there's microchips. Bill Gates is trying to microchip us all in one way or another, whatever it might happen to be, certain foods, vaccines, whatever it is. And they get all up in arms about that. And yet they gladly carry around a device that we just talked about.
Yeah.
Is an entire network.
Yeah.
Interconnected network that can pinpoint you quite precisely
wherever you go.
And we don't seem to care about that. You know, it's very weird.
Well, the other thing too is, and it's gotten, you know, more and more. You go anywhere and now there's cameras. There's cameras everywhere. So, I mean, they can sit there and tell, you know, say when you got off the thruway and you went up this highway and went over to here and that. There are so many cameras around right now.
Right.
You know.
Well, and the newer cars are also tracking you every second.
Yeah.
There've been cases with the cars that have driver assist. There are no cars that are self-driving.
Right.
They're driver assist, no matter what they say. Someone had an accident and they look into the logs of the car, because it's a computer with wheels, and say, yeah, you had driver assist on, you weren't holding onto the wheel like you're supposed to, so, you know, it's your fault.
Right. Right. Well, I was looking at a couple of new cars. I was looking at the it was one of those rabbit holes.
Yeah.
You know how you fall down the rabbit holes? There's a new battery technology, aluminum ion batteries, which are supposed to be much more energy dense and charge much faster. So they're saying those will be great for electric cars. So I started looking at electric cars, and then of course Ford came out with the F-150.
F-150. Oh,
well, the Mustang Mach-E.
What?
The Mustang Mach-E.
And the Mustang Mach-E, and so I was looking at those, and on and on and on. But that was one of the things that I was looking at, was how they have the self-driving, and the companies that call it self-driving, the companies that call it driver assist, the companies that just call it lane assist.
Yeah.
You know, they're all using different language for what is essentially the same thing.
Did you see that promo, though, for the F-150?
Which one?
There's one where they line up all the F-150s.
Yeah. And the one tows them?
And then they
put them in the train cars?
Put them in the car. The lady that's driving that?
She's the one.
She's the one that designed this new car. And the power that has to be able to tow that much?
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, the one before that, the hybrid F-150, is a huge seller, particularly in the South. Not because they're all hot for electric cars, but because it has an unbelievable generator. Mm-hmm. So if your electricity goes out, you can use that generator to power your house.
And that's what they got in the new F-150.
Yeah. There's commercials where you plug your tools into the back of it. There's a regular 120 outlet.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is so inefficient, converting DC to AC back to DC so you can convert it to AC.
But that's how powerful that generator is, that it can actually do that without a problem.
Yeah, you can drive for 300 miles or you can run your house for a week.
Exactly. That is exactly it. So, yeah, we're seeing that and more and more.
Well, the F-150 is the most profitable vehicle Ford ever came out with. Well, any vehicle.
I think it's the best-selling brand in the world.
Yes,
ever.
It is. As far as single vehicle.
And it's only sold in the U.S.
Yeah.
The one single vehicle is the Ford F-150.
And in all its various incarnations.
Yeah.
So the new Lightning, I think, is going to... The hybrid, which I forget what they call that one, but the hybrid is a huge seller because of that generator. And I honestly think that the Lightning is going to also be a huge seller.
The big thing I see right now, and you know, you can go buy a lot of car dealerships and everything else, and this has to do not only with cars, but computers and anything else you folks might be ordering, all of a sudden it's put on delay, is because of the chip manufacturers. A lot of the chip manufacturers had to shut down.
Yep.
Just to, due to COVID all around the world. So a lot of chips, there's hundreds of chips now that are used in, you know, like your vehicles, even in your phones, everything else. And that's why.
Say there's a stadium in Michigan full of Ford trucks waiting for chips to come in.
Yeah. You could go on Mount Reed. Normally they're by the old Delco plant. They have all the cars lined up there that are ready to go out. That lot's empty right now.
Right.
Literally empty because they
can't get the chips to finish the car. Cars are ready to go.
Yeah.
Except for those chips.
Kentucky Speedway, that's what it was. They're at a racetrack, just thousands of them just sitting there.
Yep.
And it's not just chips, too. I've been reading about lumber prices have skyrocketed, and new home construction has jumped 25%.
Yep.
For the car.
Well, the guy, there's an ad there. The guy said, all right, I'll trade for, what was it, a 68 Vet, and he shows all this plywood.
Yeah, box of plywood.
He says, no low balls. I know what I got.
Yeah. Or in my hobby community, it's balsa wood.
Right.
And people are taking a box of balsa to Antiques Roadshow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But what's the other one? Another guy was saying that apparently ammunition is low, too.
Yeah.
And so you really want to annoy someone, you shoot a 9mm into a box of balsa.
Yeah.
You're wasting bullets. And wood.
I have a friend who stockpiles ammunition. He buys ammo like I buy 3D printing filament. And he was saying, I could pay off my house on this if I auctioned it off.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, you probably could. Last week, Dennis told us about a site called A Better Route Planner, or if you prefer Route Planner, I don't care. abetterrouteplanner.com, and you can say, okay, I'm going to take this route. I have this kind of car, and it will tell you where all the charging stations are, this kind of electric car.
Mm-hmm.
And it will tell you where all the charging stations are and how long you will have to spend at each one to charge your vehicle.
Cool.
Now, it doesn't talk about cost, right? Because some will be in your network, and they're theoretically, you know, you get 10,000 free hours or whatever that is, and some will cost you money because they're not in your network. So it doesn't tell you what that's going to be because it can't know that information.
Yeah.
But it certainly can tell you where all the chargers are. I was very, very impressed by that. It makes life. I mean, I know that most.
That's going to be the way of the future, though.
Yeah, I know that most electric cars have an app that will tell you locally where you can charge.
And I've seen they're adding it to Google Maps and Apple Maps, too, that you can put in recharge stations along the way.
Right. So there's a lot of that stuff going on. It's pretty impressive, actually. All right, that's it. You've wasted an hour of your life with this nonsense, but don't go away. We've got a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe coming your way. That's a whole nother hour of Dave Enright, a whole nother hour of Steve Ray, and sadly, a whole nother hour of me, Nick Francesco. You can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. We're taking a slightly longer break, so you can take a bio break if you need to, but we will be back in just a few minutes with a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show, Sound Bites, right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we can continue to be solely member supported. Jazz 90.1. We will see you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester.
A public service of the Greece Central School District.
Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. You are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like Ed did from Rochester, New York. Hi, Ed. What's up?
Hi, guys. I just was curious if there's any way to tell from an email that you get, say, for example, from a credit bureau, that there's a credit alert that they received. It looks legit. Everything about it looks, in this case, it was Experian. Number, the 800 number, whatever number they give you. The first thing the computer asks is for your Social Security number. I don't know any more the way the some of the scams are so sophisticated, like from Chase Bank or whatever, that you don't even have an account with. How in the world can you tell so you don't fall into some hole that you can't get rid of if you give out your Social Security number, even if it's to a quote-unquote computer?
Well, never call or a number or click a link in an email from a bank or any other place like that. Go look them up. Go to their real website. Make sure you're on their real website and do it that way. So I get them, you know, I get them all the time. Your account has been compromised. Please click here.
I had this week.
I don't have an account at that bank, so it's pretty unlikely it was not. Even if it is, I then go to my bank's website, which I have bookmarked because I go there regularly because I check my account all the time. And I go there and I see there are no messages from anybody. And so I know it's a fake email. And that's the way you do it. You do your due diligence. Never call a number in an email. Never click on a link in an email. Do your own research. If it's a bank you use, then you absolutely know their number already. Or you can find it because you go to their website.
My bank usually calls me if there's an issue.
Don't ask you for information.
No.
Because they know who you are because they called you.
And in the case of Experian, they did have a breach a couple years ago and all 300 million U.S. Credit holders were breached. There are ways to look at the raw source and the long headers of the email and see if the link is right and if the from is right and what the routing
and
is.
And if it's secure one.
But you have to know what's right ahead of time to know if what's in there is right.
Right. That's fairly technical stuff. In your particular case, Ed, I would say if they're asking you for your Social Security number right off the crack like that, they're not legit.
Yeah,
well,
really.
Well, part of it is because your credit is so tied to your Social Security number, to check if you've had a credit breach, it's usually in your Social Security number.
Yeah, but even so, don't never click on a link in an email. Mm-hmm. Never call a number in an email. Do it outside the email. Find out who they are. So Experian has a website. On that website, you can do all kinds of stuff. It also has their legit real phone number.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay, good. All righty. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you.
And you have to be careful on your web searches, too, because you can do a search for a company phone number, and the bad guys will buy ads with that search result, and so you get the wrong Apple, the wrong Microsoft, the wrong Citibank.
Right. Microsoft support really just means somebody's willing to support a Microsoft product, not it's Microsoft giving you support.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very aware and very careful of that. If you go to the website and it's not Microsoft.com, then it's not Microsoft.
Yeah.
I can advertise Microsoft support and buy an ad on Google that says I do Microsoft support. And it would be perfectly legitimate because I'm answering Microsoft computer questions.
The search engines are trying to get better about weeding out and crap like that, but they're not perfect.
And a lot of times they rely on people to complain.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other side of that issue, of course, is there's always somebody who's willing to complain about something somewhere. So they have to weed out the legitimate complaints from just the disgruntled, grumpy old people. It's a long, involved, lengthy, fraught process, and it's fraught with danger because people are so sue happy these days.
Yeah, and Microsoft is finally and officially killing Internet Explorer.
Yeah,
so we should start hearing complaints about that. I've been using it for years.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem.
You've been using it,
and Microsoft hasn't been updating it.
Yeah.
Microsoft Internet Explorer is finally dying. That's gone. Microsoft 10X, we hardly knew ye, and you're gone. So we'll see. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. Hi, James. What's up?
Oh, hello. I have an HP printer. It's about 3-4 years old. And all of a sudden, it's just printing blank pages, but the ink is loaded and everything. Do you know what that would be?
Oftentimes, it's a clogged print head.
Yeah.
Most printers will have a clean print head option in either the front panel of the printer or in the utility on your computer. Sometimes, though, they get clogged up so bad that you can't use the printer anymore. If you're lucky, you can replace the print head. Some printers, the print head is separate from the ink tank, and some printers, it's one. So every time you replace the ink tank, you're also replacing the head, but it depends on your specific model of printer. And but usually by the time you replace all your heads, you're better off buying a new printer.
Yeah, so...
That's exactly what I'm going to do. It's not worth monkeying around because I do quite a lot of printing. Also, quick question for you concerning... I have an old laptop that... I can't get any power plugged into and all that, but it's got stuff on it. There's nothing wrong. Just can't load it up. Can that stuff be transferred to a new laptop?
What you'd want to probably do, and you can buy them relatively inexpensive from Amazon, is pull the hard drive out, and then you can get an enclosure, which you'd slip it into, and it has a... when you put it in this enclosure, you... snap it together, and it comes with a USB cable.
So it makes the internal drive an external drive you can plug into another computer.
And then you can read all the files.
And it can be copied to the new computer?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and then...
What's the name of that product again, please?
It's just an external enclosure.
A USB enclosure is usually what they're called.
But you have to see whether it's for... Depending on how old the hard drive is, whether it's an IDE or... One of the new SATAs.
Yeah, SATA or IDE or PETA.
Yeah.
So, it's a 10-year-old Toshiba.
You'll have to look at the specs on the drive to see what
connector
it has.
When you pull the drive out, if it has a lot of pins on it, that's IDE. If it just has two clips on it, that's SATA.
Okay.
So, like I say, plus one, the other benefit is once you move all your files off of that, you format it. And now you got yourself an external backup drive.
Yeah, very good. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Yeah, you can also do a Google search for IDE versus SATA connector and take a look at the pictures, and you'll see which one is you have.
Okay. How do you spell SATA?
SATA.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Okay.
And, of course, if that's not something you think you're going to do very often, you know, wherever you buy the computer from often has a service to transfer your data for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, they may charge you, but...
Yep.
But like I say, that's utilizing probably a decent hard drive, you know, in it, because it I'm just guessing from what he's describing is he probably snapped off the connector inside the laptop, which is very expensive to take apart and try to solder a new one in. Yep.
Right. The assumption we're making is that the hard drive is still good.
Yeah. And pull that out and boom.
Yep. And once you have done that, now he said, it was a 10-year-old computer. Yeah. So maybe that hard drive isn't in the best shape, but you could still use it as a second storage or a backup or temp files or whatever, you know, whatever. That's still a doable thing. You know, you can fairly easily make that happen. I know a lot of people. I'm doing it. I've got a Raspberry Pi on my network that has a 2 terabyte drive on it.
Yep.
And that's not, you know, my external backup. And I did the same thing. It's a full size drive, but it's an enclosure for that sort of stuff. And that's how that works. So it works out pretty easily, pretty nicely. All right, back to the phones. Is that Hamilton or Hampton?
Hampton.
Somewhere in Virginia,
Hampton,
anyway.
Hampton, Virginia.
That's correct.
Will, are you there?
I'm there, Nick. How are you?
Peachy, how are you?
Wonderful. You guys got pretty warm up there, huh?
Yes, we did. We're very excited to say that it's almost summer weather.
You got 90 yesterday.
Yeah, we hit 90 yesterday. It's in the high 70s today. How are you folks doing down there?
Oh, we had our bit of warm spell, and it's going to get hotter yet after I get out of church Sunday morning.
There you go. Well, at that point, you can sit on the veranda with a mint julep.
Indeed.
And watch the horses run in the... Oh, that's Kentucky. Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead. What's up?
I was wondering, we're talking, of course, a lot about security today, and... I was thinking back to some remarks over the suit against Apple, and here's my question. What do you guys think for somebody who's working out of the home, turning off SSID, does that add another layer of security for the individual?
It keeps casual users out but won't stop a determined hacker, because the SSID is still broadcast. It's just the name is not broadcast, but the radio signal is still there.
Right. Yeah. You can't turn off the radio signal. But as Steve said, the casual hackers, the people just driving by, the war drivers just driving by looking for Wi-Fi, won't see it. Of course, on top of that, you need to make sure that it is at least WPA2, if not 3. And you've got a good, strong password on it and another strong password on your router.
So the safest thing is to do Ethernet to everything and not have Wi-Fi at all.
Right.
But that's the least convenient thing.
Right. Yeah.
And in the absence of choosing Ethernet, you can always choose a chess gambit for your password.
There you go. Yeah, but you can turn off the SSID. And for those of you who are listening, that's basically the name.
Yeah, when you pull down your Wi-Fi menu and you see dozens of other names, you know, that's all your neighbors.
Right, that's the SSID.
Yep.
And you can decide whether or not to broadcast that to other people. If you do not broadcast it, then when you go to connect a new machine, you have to say connect to other network. You have to put the name in and then the password as well. And that's how you connect to a device that is not broadcasting its name.
Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff.
It is that.
Yep, I'm working on my A+ certification, and that's definitely one of the things, the considerations.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. Have fun with that.
Absolutely. Professor Messer's study groups are a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet they are. I bet they are.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks, Will.
All right, bye.
Stay safe, stay cool.
We should probably point out, I've been keeping track, and Nick Software's keeping track, today is our 1,000th show.
Yes, it is.
That we'll have on the server.
That we'll have on the server.
Since we started counting in December of 2001.
Right, we've had way more than 1,000 shows, but this is our 1,000th online.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting. We have years before that, but this is 1,000 up online.
And I see that page on the archives. That doesn't look like 1,000 lines of 1,000.
Right. Right.
When you start going to columns, you didn't have to go down 1,000 rows.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It looks like a lot less. But you can see all those just by going to our website at soundbites.org. Going to the archives, or just going to soundbites.org/archives.
Can your variable hold a 4-digit number?
Yeah. Boy, I hope so.
Yeah.
Kind of late to think about it now, isn't it?
Right. We've got 999 shows, and money ain't one. But we this is our 1,000th show online, and you can go back and listen to any of them you like. That's one of the services we offer. And let me take this opportunity to thank those people who have donated to Soundbites itself, who have been very generous to do that by helping keep the site alive. It's your donations that let me pay for the storage of all those episodes. And
it ain't free.
It ain't free. But yeah, so we're very honored that you folks have been kind enough to help keep the site alive. We're very, very pleased that you are willing to do that. That is, of course, separate from the becoming a member of the station. Station membership keeps us on the air. That donation keeps things like the site live.
So you can go back to older episodes.
Yep. And Steve makes sure that there's a posting for each one of those episodes that lists who we talked to and what we talked about. So that's wonderful. And that's all part of our deal here. That's what we do.
And Apple just started a new podcast analytics thing. If you publish through Apple, which we do.
Right.
And you have to pay to get all the extra services.
Of course you do.
If you're trying to do a commercial podcast and make money off of it, they're adding a paid subscription tier. So one of the neat things about podcasts is I've always been that it's pretty much always been free to subscribe to a podcast. There are people that try to do paid podcasts with a hidden URL
right.
that you have to type in manually instead of being listed in a podcast directory. So now Apple is starting to add that for people that are using the Apple Podcast Network to distribute their stuff. I've been trying to get it in Spotify and Google Play, and it doesn't like something in the podcast producer we have on the website.
They keep updating it. They just updated it this week again.
So yeah, maybe I'll try doing it again. I keep getting errors trying to find it on the other services.
How weird is that? But yeah, you can do that. You can also, I think, just grab the URL, the RSS feed if you've got.
Yeah, you can put it into any RSS reader.
So if you're using something like ProtoPage or one of those, you can do it there as well. All right, one more. I love this news story. I have to admit, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and officials from 6 states this week sued Frontier Communications, alleging that the telecom provider misrepresented internet speeds and charged many customers for higher speeds that it did not actually provide, nor was it capable of providing them. The lawsuit concerns the advertised speeds of DSL, which Frontier offers over copper lines in places where it has not upgraded to fiber to the home. Frontier's failure to invest sufficiently in fiber was a major cause of its bankruptcy last year. Frontier provides residential DSL internet service to about 1.3 million customers across 25 states. The inherent limitations of copper line DSL means its speeds are slower for customers who live farther away from the nearest fiber node. A consultant study found that nearly 30% of Frontier's DSL customers were likely to receive speeds slower than what they paid for, the lawsuit said. The FTC lawsuit alleged that Frontier often imposed speed caps that were lower than the speeds customers paid for, saying that the ISP provisioned consumers for slower speeds than the tiers of DSL internet service to which they are subscribed. So that's two things. One is, because of the technology, you're probably not getting the speeds you're paying for.
Up to 8 megabits.
Up to 8 megabits. Yeah. The weasel more, word of up to.
More likely 4.
Or 2.
Or 3 or 2, yeah.
And then, on top of that, they were also capping your speed at a lower speed than you were paying for. So even if you could get it, you weren't getting it. Since at least January of 2015, thousands of consumers complained to Frontier and government agencies that the company failed to provide DSL internet service at the speeds they were promised. Many consumers have complained that the slower speeds actually provided by Frontier failed to support the typical online activities they should have been able to perform at the speed tiers Frontier had sold them, particularly these days when for the last year everybody's been working from home. Video conferencing is the norm. Schools are being done through video conferencing, and people are being left behind, particularly in rural and less affluent areas, simply because Frontier has been capping them. Frontier issued a statement calling the lawsuit baseless, saying that its DSL internet speeds have been clearly and accurately articulated, defined, and described in the company's marketing materials and disclosures. Indeed, Frontier ads prominently display a price and maximum speed, while stating in tiny and conspicuous print separated from the main message of the advertisement that, and I quote, maximum service speed is not available to all locations, and the maximum speed for service to your location may be lower than the maximum speed in this range, unquote. In other words, Frontier advertises speeds to specific customers despite knowing it cannot and will not provide those speeds. Are you getting the speeds Frontier promised? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, I had a surprise this week. I came downstairs and went to my office, looked out the window, and there's wires dangling in my yard. And I'm going, ah, crap, what fell down now?
You're right.
So I get outside. There's a brand new spool of Corning fiber sitting in my driveway. Yeah.
Excellent.
Just sitting in my driveway. Apparently, you know, because my car was still there, they couldn't get the cherry picker in to hook it. So as I'm pulling out of the driveway, I see the cherry picker three houses up.
Yeah, there you go.
Then when I got home that night, it's hooked up to the house. So I've got installation coming this week.
Nice. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dave had an interesting situation many years ago in the old shop where your DSL was on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, so I literally
the central office, which is neither central nor an office, was on the other side of his wall, so he got the fastest possible DSL speed available.
When they first turned it on, you know, because the guy literally came out of that office around into ours, and he says, all right, I'm going to hook you up. I said, okay. So I did, and he goes, well, you know, pound on the wall if it's not this or this. I said, okay. So we're doing some testing, and Dan and I were playing with it, and all of a sudden, I literally pounded on the wall. Walt, I still remember the guy. Walt came around and said, what's going on? So he showed him. He goes, I'll fix this in a minute. He goes back over to the other office. 10 minutes later, boom, we're back up in speed now. Yeah. Yep. He says, any problems, just let me know. He says, you know where I am. I says, you know where we are. And, you know, it was a great relationship.
Yeah, they say you have to be within 20,000 feet of the CO to get a decent signal. And right. What, you were less than 2 feet?
Yeah, yeah, right. Literally, the other side of the wall. Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't run it out the front of the building, around the side, dig a trench, and come into your
bed. Yeah, right. And, of course, it was a modern building, so the walls weren't very thick.
Yeah.
He was within a foot, really.
What it was is they rearranged, because my office was first on the back. And then I opened up the other panel so I could have the front, and I went off to the left. Well, originally I was to the right, so it was sort of L-shaped. If you were looking south, going north, it'd go up and then to the right. They wanted that space on the right. I said, okay, no problem. Yeah. You know, you redo my office, and which they did.
You just had a couple early mornings where you turned right and bumped into a wall.
Yeah, and they put up this wall. And they said, okay, the DSL is going to be right over here, and we'll hook you up as soon as we get it connected. Fine with me.
Yep.
And boom, we had it, and then you came over.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my fault.
Yep.
I know it's my fault. All right. We should probably...
We're just coming up on it right now. Yeah. Good time.
All right. We'll take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes. With Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 30 minutes after the hour. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. And we'll be back with the rest of the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, member supported Jazz 90.1.
online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. We did have a couple of text messages come in, and these were had enough information that we could answer them. One says, I've got some online files that are PHP files, and I haven't any anything that will convert them to MP4s or QuickTime, and they're public domain files, but I can't convert them. And that's because PHP is a programming language. It's like having something written in C or Python or BASIC. Inside that PHP file will be a link to the playable document, but the file itself is not a playable document. And that's the problem. You'd have to download the PHP document itself.
Which is the source code of the program.
Which is the source code of the program. And look within that for a link to the PHP, to the MP3 or QuickTime or whatever file.
And hope it's not obscured in like a JavaScript query or something.
Right. But that's why you can't convert it, because it's apples and oranges. You're trying to convert a programming language into a playable media file, which isn't going
to
work.
There are some programs that will try to find a video stream on a website,
right,
and allow you to download it from that website. I've never really found any of them to work that well. But if you search for video download helper or download video from website,
there's one on Linux called YouTube-DL, way more than YouTube.
Yeah, a lot of times they're mostly designed for YouTube, but they can find streams on any video,
right?
On any video stream on any website.
But I haven't found a comparable product for anything else. We also got a check. We did not get a check. We might have gotten a check. I don't know if he's a member. We got a text from Jerry from Rochester. About he's got a Mac M1. There's a utility to translate Rosetta 2. Is that compatible with Rosetta 1? He's got an old game that he used to be able to play under Rosetta 1 and cannot play under Rosetta 2. Take it away, Steve.
Short answer is no. Apple has... What? My computer just crashed. Someone had a Mac question and my Mac question...
It was shock. It was just utter shock.
Kernel panic. My kernel panicked.
And his assistant? Private parts.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So Apple has shifted their major processors several times over the years. The current shift is from the Intel series processors into their own Apple Silicon. And so Rosetta 2 will take a program that is written in Intel code and translate it into Apple Silicon code, basically ARM code. And it's a translate on the fly when you first launch the program. About 10, 15 years ago, Apple did the same thing. They switched from the IBM PowerPC architecture to the Intel architecture. And Rosetta 1 was the code back then that translated your PowerPC instructions into your Intel instructions. That's all it did. So it can't translate Intel into Apple Silicon because that's not what it does. And actually before that, they used the Motorola 68000.
Right.
And they had they didn't call it Rosetta, but they had a similar thing for running your 68000 programs. In fact, a lot of times there was actually a coprocessor card that you could put in your Mac to run the older software actually in hardware. But from what we've seen, a lot of those old games that were out in the early Macs, the PowerPC Macs or even the Motorola Macs, is that you can find them at archive.org. They have archived a lot of the old games, and many of those old games work just fine in a web browser on a modern computer. Ironically, a current computer can emulate a 20-year-old computer really well, and you might be able to play that game again on a newer computer. Otherwise, you have to have an old computer still running. 10.6 is the last OS that supported Rosetta 1, so that you can go back and play those really old games.
So basically, there's a Rosetta that will translate from Intel to M1.
PowerPC to Intel was Rosetta 1.
No, I'm saying you now have one that will translate from Intel to M1.
Which is Rosetta 2.
But the one that before that that translated from PowerPC to Intel is no longer available.
Right.
And nothing translates from PowerPC to M1.
Right.
Okay, got it. Thank you. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Dave from Macedon, New York. What's up, Dave?
Yeah, hi. I love your show.
Thanks.
I've been a long-time listener.
That's what we like to hear.
My question is about Chromebooks and Linux.
Yeah.
I've been doing a little Python programming on a Raspberry Pi, but I'd like to be able to do some playing around on a Chromebook. And my current Chromebook doesn't support Linux or anything. But the question is, if I got a new one, would that support running Python like an IDE or something where I could get into it and play around with Python?
Heck yes. And more precisely, oh, heck yes. I am running a Chromebook right now, and I am running Linux. And under Linux, I am running currently three Python programs. None of them is particularly powerful. So even on my low-end Chromebook, they're all running fine. But they are running. So in fact, I do very much what you do. I tend to test my Python programs on my Raspberry Pi 4, and then I move them to my main machine or my Chromebook for running. Currently, I have It's not what I wanted to do at all. I currently have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 16 Python programs on this machine. And
all right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 more in another folder. So 31, I have 31 Python programs. Clearly, I'm not running them all at once, but they're all on here. And I can run them anytime I want. On this machine. So what now, let me suggest that if you are going to run Python programs on your Chromebook, you need a newer Chromebook because it's got to run Linux, which is about to be out of beta, by the way. And you definitely want to have a minimum of 4 gig and better 8 gig of RAM.
Okay.
Just to give everybody a little bit of elbow room.
Yeah. Do I need, something better than that, than typical shell run processor? Do I have to jump up?
I'm running a Core M3 on this machine, and it is plenty fast for the stuff I'm doing. Now, obviously, it depends a lot on what you're doing, obviously. But, this works really quite well, I have to say, quite well indeed. And so you should be able to run pretty much any Python utility. That is to say, not a massive. I mean, obviously, if you're trying to run your entire business with Python code, you're going to want at least a very high-end Chromebook. And at that point, you might as well get yourself a Linux desktop or rather laptop. But for most code, you can easily run it on a Chromebook without any trouble at all.
Great. All right. I was doing a little web server, and I have a temperature gauge, and it's on a Raspberry Pi and runs a web server, and I can see the temperature on my phone anywhere in the house, whatever.
Yeah. As long as that temperature gauge thing is USB so that it'll connect into the Chromebook and you've got the drivers for it, written in Python or whatever, you're good to go.
Okay. All right. That's my question, I guess.
There you go. That's your answer.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Have fun.
And you still haven't gotten the 400 yet?
Shut up. I know. I'm waiting now. I've decided I want to wait for the 8 gig model.
The 500.
I want to wait for an 8 gig model. It's a 4 gig model, and every time I get that lust, I cool it by saying, waiting for the 8 gig model. Do I need 8 gig? Oh, heck no. I'm not even using the 4. I'm not using the 8 gig in my Chromebook.
One of my Pis I want to strip down, and because right now I've got it running off an SD card.
Yeah.
I'm going to convert it now and format an SSD hard drive.
Yep.
And have it run right off of that, because that's even faster.
Yep. There are hats you can add to pretty much any Raspberry Pi to do that.
Because, yeah, and I mean, they've added so many other features now to the latest version of ARM that it's, yeah, I'm going to look at that.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. The, I've
Ken, where you come from?
Really, I've lusted after the Raspberry Pi 4. There is no other word for it. Do I need one? No. That has nothing to do with lust. Nothing whatsoever to do with lust. I want one. And I have so far at least managed to cool my jets.
You're making your existing pies jealous. I mean, it's the problem is that the current one is never enough. You always need the next one.
Well, yeah, I don't know what I did, but you know, because I've got two Raspberry Pi 4s, so they're the same. And but one of them, when I they're both hooked up to this little hub, and the one is running, you know, only 100 megabit. Versus the others running gigabit.
Yep.
And I don't know what I did to one versus the other, because I loaded the same operating system on both, but I did something to mess one of them up that it's only running 100.
I think you have to tell it you've got gigabit.
Well, you can go into, when it first boots, you got to hit the escape, and you got to go into the menus there in Pi. To change until it used, you know, the four gig limit, and then also the screen size,
right?
So right. I thought, oh, what the heck? I'm gonna just move those few files that I have on it right now over to the other Pi, and take this hard drive and just format it with Raspbian,
and just do it,
and just do load it right onto that and run it off of that.
Yep.
See how it works.
Makes sense to me.
Yep.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ken from Rochester, New York. What's up, Ken?
Hi, fellas. It's good to speak with you again, and thank you again for doing the show.
Thank you. What can we do for you?
Well, I called you a while back, and Nick primarily gave me the information, but you all gave me a little bit of everything. I was trying to create a multiple boot session, and you gave me first choice with extended operating system loader. XOSO. I looked into that, and I was very grateful that the information at the very beginning of the informational clearly stated if you don't have a fairly depth, and if you don't really have an in-depth understanding of Linux, you might struggle.
Right.
So I quickly moved on to VirtualBox.
Yep.
And I looked into that, and I decided, you know what, this looks really great. I looked at the documentation, and I'll tell you, I'm a document type of guy.
Yeah,
I was pretty blown away. I mean, detail is anybody who wants to see detail, just look at the documentation that comes with Virtual Machine.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. So I started looking into it, and I said, okay, let's try this. So I was thinking about trying to install it, and you know, their documentation was so detailed that I couldn't really find the right way to do it. So I went out on the web and I did find some information and I did it. And I was I'm still in the process of tinkering with it, with loading Linux ISO. And I've got that part all squared away pretty much. But I had two questions. One was, I noticed the choice for VirtualBox shows up not only in my admin side of Windows, but it shows up in the, the guest account.
Right.
Is it advantageous to use, say, one of the VirtualBox OSs, you know, on the, non-administrator side?
Well, in general, you should never use the administrator account for anything except administering the box.
Okay.
So you should always be running as a standard user, not necessarily a guest, but as a standard user. And in that particular setup, then there's no reason not to run VirtualBox there. Once you've set it up as an admin and given access to everybody, which it looks like you've already done, you should be able to run it as any person and that person should be able to run a set of their own virtual machines.
Okay, so what you're saying is it's safer than, say, if I were just to use straight-up Windows in that account.
It is always safer to not be the admin.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, we're talking about now not being on the admin side. We're on, the other user.
Right.
I keep forgetting the name of it.
It doesn't matter. You can call them anything. You can add as many users as you want. The point is, if you are running VirtualBox as that other user, you are doubly safe. It is very hard for stuff to jump out of VirtualBox into the real world, and it is then doubly hard for it to jump from a regular user to the admin.
Ah, you nailed it.
There we go.
That's what I was trying to ascertain. So that was all good, and I wanted to, again, mention that, Dave, you know, you're always talking about how this system or that system on the web has, you know, Google or whatnot for free storage based on what you're doing and mm-hmm. how now they're starting to charge. And I have to quote a famous guy by the name of Mr. Dave Enright, who always says, folks, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, sooner or later, I think it always catches up to us.
Yeah, yep. You're absolutely right.
Yep.
Yeah,
Google's been using the free photo storage to train its object recognition library so it can do captures on you.
Right, exactly.
Click all the traffic signs. I did. No, you didn't. Yes, I did.
Yes, I did. Wow. One of the things that, and what's interesting is, you know how sometimes you get two sets?
Mm-hmm.
That first set, they know where all the traffic signs are. The second set, you're teaching them.
Ah.
So even if you get it wrong, you get in.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ken, that's where also, that's why we've been encouraging folks to play around with Raspberry Pis.
Okay.
Right now, they are so inexpensive. They're fun to play with. And just like you followed these other instructions, setting up a Raspberry Pi, there are so many videos out there right now. We've been talking about ARM is a version of Windows 10. And then they also have another version called Twister that looks like and has the feel of Windows, and it already installs LibreOffice and everything else. So you've got these other little boxes that you can hook up SSD drives to and create your own little servers right off the side that, you know, again, like we've always said, you know, backup, backup, backup. You never have enough backups. I've literally got 4 different places now that I back stuff up to. Is it redundant to us all get out? Probably. But you know what? If anything crashes, I don't worry because I can go to one of my sources and I've got it. And it's so inexpensive. It's so inexpensive. It would be foolish not to spend that type of money to protect it because it's important to me.
Right. And Ken, for somebody like you who's looking to play with Linux.
Yeah.
Having something like a Raspberry Pi separates it from Windows so that it's mm-hmm. you know it's safe because it's not even on your Windows system.
Yep.
And you can buy a full Raspberry Pi 400 for $100 with a keyboard and a mouse. All you need to do now is plug it into a monitor, and you can and many people plug it into most monitors nowadays have two HDMI ports. And you just switch the input when you want to go on the other machine.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to buy a new monitor, just a monitor cable. And so, you know, when you graduate from VirtualBox to wanting to put it on its own machine, take a look at a Raspberry Pi, even the Raspberry Pi 400 or the 4. Either one would be fine.
Yeah, and like I say, under $100.
Yeah, well,
I'll take that back. About $150
if you're gonna get a monitor.
All in, yeah. If you want to go all in.
Well, you know something. Every time you guys speak about these things, I do go out and do a little research, like the 100, or is it the 400?
400.
The 400 is the one with the keyboard
that Nick's getting pretty soon.
Well, I started with a VIC 20, so I'm familiar with a keyboard.
There you go.
Didn't we all?
But I'll tell you, Nick, every time you two guys start kibitzing, You know, I see this picture of Nick standing on the side of the swimming pool, and he keeps putting his foot, his toe in the way. Wow, you know, this just isn't, it's not quite right yet. And David's like, come on, man, jump in the pool.
I know, I'm looking at it now, the Raspberry Pi 400 kit at Canakit. Canakit.com, CANAKIT.com.
Well, like
$100 for the keyboard with the computer in it, a 16 gig SD card. It's got 4 gig of RAM. It comes with a mouse. It comes with the power supply. It comes with the HDMI cable.
Just get it instead of the SD drive. Get an SSD hard drive. Yeah, plenty of storage.
Well, if you're just playing, if you're just learning. You can get in for $100.
Oh yeah.
And then if you want to add, you know, if you scroll down, you can see they've got a 500 gig hard drive for $85.
Yeah.
Well, duh.
You know. Oh yeah. No. It's so inexpensive, but you can have fun with it, learn a heck of a lot of stuff, and create something that is very useful.
Yep.
And it didn't spend, you know, hundreds of dollars. And if it messes up, oh, well, I'll just redo it. It's not that hard.
Yep.
No, I think anybody who's familiar with computers, especially hardware, will realize that those numbers alone are advantageous to look into it for anyone, including myself. When I get to a point to where I've got a lot of machines, so I'm not running out of places to play. But I will in the future. I'll probably go more towards the kind you're using now, which is a separated box versus a keyboard, because it fascinates me. I'm thinking, it brings back memories of
exactly.
The old Vic-20.
Actually, I tend to do remote desktop into my Pi 4, so I don't even need. I really don't need a keyboard, a mouse, because I just do remote desktop, and so
you know, I'm using 5 Raspberry Pis.
Yeah.
I don't know, Nick. I see you're going to jump in, man.
I am. I got my toe in the water, but I'm looking at that diving board and edging over to it. I get it.
Well,
I hear it more and more in your voice. And Dave is so smart. He just kind of inches you there. You know?
He does. He's there behind.
I got to get back at him for that one day.
Oh, how is that my fault? I offered to call you at 11 o'clock.
I told you, you will pay. You will
I
pay.
Offered to call you at 11 p.m. so you would go to bed. Mm-hmm. Do not blame me.
Mm-hmm. Payback's up. Mm.
Yeah, I know that. All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. We appreciate it.
All right, you too. Thank you. And you guys have a splendid day.
Stay safe.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
I'm not taking the rap for this. All right, that music tells me that mercifully we're done for another show.
Yeah, baby.
I want to thank everybody who called in. And as I said, we do prefer that you call in rather than text in because we make sure we get all the information we need to properly answer your question. But I want to thank Dave Enright. I don't know. Maybe I don't want to thank. I definitely want to thank Steve Ray. As long as you're off camera. And I'm Nick Francesco. You've been listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you that with your generous, kind assistance, we remain public supported Jazz 90.1. We will be back next week. So be good to one another. Stay safe, stay cool, and we will see you in just 166 hours.
This is 90.1 WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District.